Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Now 90% of the apples eaten in North America are from just 12 varieties, and most kids can only name two or three different apples, if that.
That's down from 16,000 different varieties of apples Americans had access to at one point in history. Author, ethnobotanist, and apple lover Gary Paul Napan will be with us to talk about which heirloom apple varieties are his favorite. In the kitchen, Chef Daniel Orr uses some apples from a tree in his garden to make his grandma's apple pie. We visit a local artisan who uses the spent grain from a local brewery to make unique paper products. And author Sandor Katz talks about his passion for preserving food. Stay with us. Mia Partlow brings us foodie news and notes at the top of every show. Mia.
Good to see you, Annie. Do the words fast food diet sound appealing? Researchers at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis are paying people to gain weight by consuming fast food at the rate of an extra 1,000 calories a day. The researchers are trying to determine why only some people gain weight. In order to get accurate results, they must test humans. Participants can earn up to $3,500 for gaining weight quickly and then losing it, all under doctor's supervision. Participants, like 50-year-old nurse Dawn Freeman, said at first the process seemed, quote, wonderful, unquote. However, a few weeks in, she began to feel the adverse effects of both the food and the weight it put on her. She has since completed the program with a total gain of 16 pounds in 8 weeks. For those allergic to poison ivy, the reaction to exposure is an uncomfortable, itchy rash. One scientist suffered until she decided to do something about it. Rebecca Braslaw and her colleagues at the University of California, Santa Cruz, have developed a spray that would detect the presence of the oil in poison ivy, poison oak, and poison sumac that causes the itchy rash. Braslaw says more testing needs to be completed before the spray can be used on skin, but it can detect the presence on hiking boots and other sturdy equipment. Omnivores take note. A long-term study from the Loma Linda University in California claims vegetarians live longer lives. The Adventist Health Study began monitoring Seventh-day Adventists in the 1970s and 80s. The sample group is currently half-finished with their current study. On average, vegetarian males lived 9.5 years longer, and vegetarian females lived 6.1 years longer than the average Californian. Plant-based diets help, scientists believe, but vegetarians are also more likely to participate in other healthy habits, like regular exercise and avoidance of cigarettes. Finally, how do you like your eggs? Your answer could predict your personality type. Researchers in Britain used data mining to correlate egg consumption with personality. They found that participants who like poached eggs are outgoing and happier, while those who preferred scrambled eggs are more guarded. Boiled egg eaters are disorganized, fried egg eaters have a higher sex drive, and omelet eaters are self-disciplined. Read more about these stories on our website, eartheats.org. And join the conversation on our social media platforms. Search for Earth Eats on Twitter and Facebook.
Mia Partlow brings us the latest in food news every week. Thanks for being here.
You got it.
Twisted Limb Paperworks has been an innovator in sustainably produced stationery since 1998, creating handmade, 100% recycled products from office paper, junk mail, and grocery bags. Sometimes more unusual materials find their way into the paper, like grass clippings. Most recently, they've started using the spent barley from Upland Brewing Company to create 4 beer-inspired colors of paper, a process that is garnering national buzz. I stopped by the shop to get the scoop on Twisted Limb's beer paper.
I'm very excited about this, and I'm a little anxious because we are the first people, or the first studio to ever make beer paper.
In the state?
Ever.
Ever?
Ever.
So naturally, Cheryl Woodhouse Keyes, the founder and owner of Twisted Limb Paperworks, is a little shy about sharing the details of her papermaking process. Her beer paper, using spent barley from Upland Brewing Company, is getting a lot of attention from beer clubs and breweries all over the country who want it for invitations, thank you cards, and menus. She says the idea for Beer Paper started when she was trying to find a uniquely local spin for her business.
But I really kind of wanted to come up with things from the Bloomington environment that we could recycle that were kind of more novel than just the grass out of my lawn.
She considered using the algae that was growing on Griffey Lake, but that idea fell through. It was after attending a community meeting with Doug Dayhoff, president of Upland, that she decided to pursue the possibility of using barley. Upland produces 20,000 pounds of spent grain on an average week. Twisted Limb takes a small fraction of that, 2 5-gallon buckets, with the rest of the waste going to a local farmer and a landscaping company.
And he warned me, he says, I'm just going to tell you right now, it is going to stink really bad, so you will have to decide quickly what you're going to do with it. And I said, no worries, we are used to things smelling here. But I'll be honest, the barley takes the cake. It smells worse than anything in 14 years that we had ever experienced.
Once she figured out how to store the stuff, the next step was finding the proper ratio of barley to recycled paper, because Woodhouse Keys determined she couldn't make paper from barley alone. After some experimenting, she came up with 4 beer-inspired colors: wheat, pilsner, porter, and her personal favorite, amber. It's the amount of which colors of recycled papers she uses that she's especially concerned about keeping under wraps.
2 of the colors we made very quickly because we have similar colors. The Pilsner and the Porter were easy for us, but then we patted ourselves on the back and then we struggled for the next month. The wheat was easier and the amber eluded us for some time. It's quite close. But given this is my favorite beer, I want that color to be just right. And I'd say I have it 99% where I want it to be.
Yeah, can we take a look at some?
Yes, and I'll let you smell the barley, too.
Let me. That's a funny way to put that. Here's...
Ooh. Yeah. This is gentle. This is really nothing compared to the day it came in here.
It's a relatively small Ziploc bag. When you get the barley from Upland, how much are we talking?
Yeah, just a couple 5-gallon buckets.
How much paper are you going to make with 2 5-gallon buckets?
A lot.
Is this not what you want to talk
yes,
about?
Yes, I don't want to talk
totally
about it. I don't
mind.
Want
to. Yeah. Totally.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because you want to shout about it and tell everybody because everybody loves it. So I think that's just part of being in business, though, that once you put the idea out there, it is sort of fair game. And at least you can say you were the first, right?
You can visit Twisted Limb Paperworks at their store on South Morton Street on the Beeline Trail in Bloomington. Get more information about Cheryl Woodhouse Keys' Beer Paper by visiting their website, twistedlimbpaper.com. Gary Paul Nabhan is an author and food activist. He's been called the father of the local food movement. His many other titles also include bioterroirist and an ethnobotanist, but basically he's a foodie with a bunch of frequent flyer miles.
And so we go around the world eating our way through different cultural traditions. It's a wonderful way to spend a career.
He traveled all the way from his home in the Arizona desert to speak at the Bloomington Eats Green Conference in 2010. You've been called the father of the local food movement.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty big responsibility.
And as my wife said, who's the mother?
Right, exactly. How'd you get that title?
I don't know. It came from being in a Time magazine cover story about local versus organic, and then Mother Earth News then said I was father of the local food movement. And then I went to Carleton College to accept an honorary PhD. And I said, why am I getting this? And they said, because you're the father of the local food movement. And I said, I am? You know, so it's you wonder how these things creep up on you, you know. I would give credit to the grandparents of the local food movement, Joan Gasow and Wendell Berry and people like that, rather than trying to figure out the parentage. The grandparentage is a lot more interesting to
yeah.
me.
Since you are the father of the local food movement, what is local eating?
Local eating is paying attention to sourcing our foods from the nearest place from which we can obtain a particular food. And the definition of local depends on the environment that you're in. So people in Portland, Oregon can access fish, livestock, fruits, and vegetables from a radius of 40 miles around their home, where those of us in the desert might want to define local as a 250-mile radius.
That's right. And you try to eat now 220 miles, I believe, is what the dust jacket said.
That's right.
How difficult is that, or how easy is it?
There's a lot of variability in productivity from year to year in the desert. So I can personally do that fairly comfortably, but I'm more interested in what a community can do than an individual. All of us, if we spend enough crazy energy, can probably source most of our food from more narrow proximity than that. But if we're trying to help a community transition to a less carbon-consumptive food economy, then looking more broadly at these issues is sometimes necessary.
Yeah. And let's talk now about apples. People love apples.
I love apples.
I know. We're in sort of an apple area, I guess. We have a lot of orchards. And we know, like, Granny Smith, Red Delicious. I think the apples that people generally eat and buy from the grocery stores, you know, maybe a dozen, half dozen. There's so much more to apples than that, though.
At one time, Americans had access to 16,000 different varieties of apples, sour ones and sweet ones, red ones and yellow ones, tear-shaped ones and lumpy ones, ones that were good for making cider, others for pies, others for fritters, others for pancakes and sauces. Now 90% of the apples eaten in North America are from just 12 varieties, and most kids can only name two or three different apples, if that. And so a Red Delicious becomes all that a child thinks an apple can be. And it would be like thinking that all dogs are like Lassie and not knowing that dogs range from Chihuahuas to St. Bernards, except in this case we're missing out on incredible flavors and textures. So we're at risk of losing many of the 3,500 apples that we have left on this continent unless we do something about it soon.
Well, hearing you talk about all these varieties of apples, how did we get here? How did we get to the point where I go to the supermarket and I can only buy four or five different varieties?
Well, it's a stepwise reduction in apples that have happened over about 120 years from the first mail order apple catalogs with the beautiful color pictures that said, grow Red Delicious and you can put your kid through college or something like that. And so the thrill of having a color catalog show up with your door and then 2 weeks later an apple salesman is a great thrill for rural people. And so places like the Stark Brothers Nurseries captured the American imagination with their promotion of apples. It was much like P.T. Barnum promoting circuses. And the next thing we knew, about 100 apples were dominating trade rather than several thousand. Then the industrialization of apple production meant that people were looking for uniform apples that could be mechanically harvested and shipped in frozen boxes. So apples that had different keeping qualities from the norm that the business was looking for affected it. And then we lost tons of apples during Prohibition because most Americans were still drinking hard cider more than beer or wine up until that time. And hard cider became one of the targets of Prohibition. And by the time Prohibition was repealed, a lot of the knowledge about how to make hard cider from heirloom apple blends went out. Fortunately, we're seeing a revival in both hard and sweet ciders of heirloom apple blends.
You're an apple lover, so what's your favorite apple to eat raw right off the tree?
I love something called the candle sinap, which is a crisp, pale, fleshed apple that's sort of teardrop shape. It's from Crimea in Russia and Turkey originally, but has been grown in the U.S. for over a century. And it's just unlike any apple I've ever seen. It looks like a translucent globe of light hanging from a tree, like candles were put in a tree. It's a pale yellow skin. And it just has a crispness and freshness and kind of vanilla and cinnamon aftertastes that are just stunning.
Well, vanilla and cinnamon aftertaste, that I would put that in a pie, sounds like. What's a good apple for pie?
Well, it depends where you make the pie. In the South, people tend to like tart apples for pies, and in the North, they like sweets, and vice versa for their fresh eating apples. So it's from what kind of pie tradition that you've emerged. If you like tart apples, some in the range of the Granny Smiths. I'm not promoting Granny Smiths alone, but that have that kind of tartness or bite to them is nice. But, you know, there's apples like Magnum Bonum and Gloria Mundi that are old apple varieties that make terrific pies. And I like a lot of the Witter Pear Mains for pies, good keeping apples that then you can use a month or two after they've been picked and still have great apple pies. It used to be that apples were celebrated for being good keepers. That was the vernacular phrase for an apple that could last a long time in storage and still taste great. And I think we ought to promote the notion of good keepers as something that we want in our community again, whether they're people or apples.
I like it. Gary Paul Nabhan is the author of Where Our Food Comes From. Listen to and read my complete conversation with him on our website, where he talks about his relationships with local farmers and how that challenges him to eat differently and challenges them to grow differently. Find it at eartheats.org. Coming up, speaking of pies.
If you go in and you see a pie that has those little marks of the fingers, you can tell it's homemade, where, you know, those frozen pie doughs with their industrial seals just will never be the same.
Chef Daniel Orr makes everything from scratch for our apple pie recipe. He even picked the apples himself. Come back for that.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop. And Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Every week we speak with authors who have written everything from cookbooks to food history books, and we feature snippets of those interviews here on the program. Our book today is The Art of Fermentation by Sandor Katz. Chances are, he says, most of us started off our day with a product of fermentation, whether it was bread, coffee, or cheese. But it's not just the everyday foodstuffs.
If you walk into a gourmet food store and look around and think about the nature of the foods that you see there, almost all of the foods that we elevate to that gourmet status are products of fermentation.
Thanks to the revival of fermentation, he says more and more people are forsaking the high-end food stores and making their fermented foods themselves. It's easy, he promises. Here's 1 minute with Sandor Katz. We'll call this Fermentation 101.
The realm of fermentation that I think makes the most sense for most people who are wanting to explore this for the first time is fermenting vegetables. It's incredibly simple. All you do is take some vegetables, chop them up, shred them, create some surface area, salt them lightly to taste, spend a few minutes in a big bowl with your hands just squeezing them, bruising the vegetables, and they'll start to get really wet. Once the vegetables are nice and wet, then you stuff them into a jar. Press really hard. Get the vegetables pressed down so that they're submerged under their own juices. Then ferment them for, you know, for a few days or a few weeks. It's really an incredibly versatile process. It is intrinsically safe. There is no safer food. There has never been a case of food poisoning reported in the United States from fermented vegetables. There are very few foods that you could say that about. You don't need any special equipment. You, you know, don't need a lot of background. I have just given, you know, your listeners, you know, as much information as they need to get started. Okay, well, thank you so much. Great to talk.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Read the complete interview with Sandor Katz, where he talks about a ferment of black-eyed peas he's especially fond of these days. It's called akaraje. It's on our website, eartheats.org. In the kitchen, we're starting with dessert first today. Chef Daniel Orr has already made the pie crust. Now he's updating his grandma's apple pie recipe with some ginger, raisins, and spices.
Pie fillings should always have a nice balance of flavors. Whenever you're thinking of cooking, think of all the different places on your tongue that you taste things. So you have, you know, the salty flavors, the sweet flavors, the acidic flavors, touch of bitterness, and the sweetness. So you want to have all those in your pie filling and anything else that you cook. So whenever you ask yourself, what is this missing, go through those different flavors in your mouth. With the apple pie, you want to choose some nice sour apples. I go ahead and leave the peel on just because I think it adds a nice texture and it's healthier. It has a lot of fiber in the peel. If you peel all that away, you lose that nutritional value. Okay, we're going to add our different flavorings here. You always want to have a little bit of thickener, and that's going to be your flour. And what that does is it absorbs any liquid that comes out of your apples. One thing that my grandmother always did is she always put some oatmeal in, being Scottish. So we put some rolled oats in. Then we're going to add some of my sweet seasons. If you want to, you could use some Chinese five-spice powder or just some plain cinnamon if you wanted to. Another interesting flavor we're going to add to this and kind of update this classic apple pie is a little bit of freshly minced ginger. I always like to put a pinch of salt. Again, that kind of wakes up that other little part of your tongue. Sweetener is going to be the sugar. I like to add a little acid flavor and lemon flavor. So I'm going to add both the zest, and then we're going to add about half a lemon's worth of juice. Okay, another thing my grandmother always did was put a few raisins in. You could use raisins. I'm using white raisins today, but you could use some currants or dried cherries, dried cranberries. So make this recipe your own. Finally, we're going to add a couple liquids. We're going to add a little bit of vanilla extract. That was about a teaspoon. And then we're also going to add a little bit of brandy. You could add brandy. You could add Calvados. You could add Armagnac. Or you could even add bourbon if you want to make it real Midwestern. Now I've got a nice old pie tin that I'm going to use. I've sprayed it with a little bit of what we call Pan Buddy. Just kind of release the dough into the pie tin. And just make sure you've got a little bit of an overhang around the whole pie tin. We're going to add our filling, our apple filling. Okay, and you're going to let it go really full. You really want to have it several inches over the top. Okay, you want to bring the two pie doughs together. And then we're going to crimp the edges. Okay, we're going to take two fingers, go in between those, your thumb and your forefinger. If you go in and you see a pie that has those little marks of the fingers, you can tell it's homemade, where, you know, those frozen pie doughs with their industrial seals just will never be the same. One last detail, it's very important. What you want to do when you make one of these mile-high apple pies is you have to cut a little vent in it. And what I always like to do, and this is what my grandmother always did, she always said she was going to cut a smile into the pie. Okay, and that will allow the steam to cook out so your crust will remain nice and crisp, and it will allow the moisture to cook out and have a nice consistency in the pie.
See photos of this big mound of an apple pie on our website, eartheats.org. Two more recipes using apples, but the apples here just add a touch of sweetness to the dishes. The primary ingredient is something you've probably seen in the produce aisle but never cooked with.
All right, so today on Earth Eats, we're going to talk about sunchokes. A lot of people know them as Jerusalem artichokes, but they don't come from Jerusalem, and they're nothing like artichokes.
Oh,
so I don't know how they got that name. But as you can see, it's a tuber, it's a root. And they grow everywhere from the South clear up through Michigan. It comes from a plant that looks a lot like a sunflower. And they have a really kind of neat, nutty flavor. They're crunchy. You can eat them raw if you want to have a little taste.
Let's try this. Ooh, delicious.
A little bit fruity. Has a touch of sweetness to it. And what we're going to do today is we're going to make a soup out of them, which is a really nice way to give an introduction to sunchokes to your friends and family. So basically what we're going to do is we're going to start, as we often do, with a little bit of olive oil and some garlic, because we love our garlic here at Earthy. And to the toasted garlic, we're going to add some chopped onions.
Stop right there. You had me at garlic and onions.
Yeah, garlic and onions, that makes a house smell good. Makes the house smell like a home. And we're going to toss in the remaining ingredients, which are the sunchokes. We're going to add some potatoes to this. The sunchokes don't have a lot of starch in them, so the potatoes are going to act as your thickener and also just kind of bind everything together. After that, we're going to play on that kind of sweetness of the sunchokes with a few diced apples. And we don't want to let anything get real brown because we want to remain that real nice light color. We're going to add some of my seasoning, which we call sweet seasons. We're going to add a bay leaf and some thyme. And then we're just going to cover this with some water. Remember, anytime that you're making a soup, don't add too much liquid because you always can add more if you want it thinner, but you can't take it out once you've put it in there. In the summertime, I like to sometimes serve this cold and then maybe garnish it with some shrimp or some crab meat, which are really nice. But you also can take some of those raw sunchokes and dice them up and then put them in at the last minute, and you're going to get that crunchiness. So you'll have this real rich, creamy soup with the raw sunchokes, which will be nice and crunchy.
My heart is like an artichoke.
There's the soup, and now on to a sunchoke mousseline. These two recipes use the exact same ingredients, so only one trip to the store is necessary. They're prepared slightly differently, so they can be used in different ways in your meals. If you want to see pictures of these weird little things, go to our website, eartheats.org.
All we're going to do is we've got some diced Jerusalem artichokes. We're going to put the potatoes in next, the apples to give it that sweetness. We're going to pour a little water over the top, not much. And we're going to add some heavy cream, a little bit of nutmeg, and about 3 tablespoons of butter. So again, we're going to cook this until the cream has mostly evaporated and the potatoes and sunchokes are soft, and then we'll puree it and taste it. And it's a wonderful accompaniment for game. If you're into elk and venison and bison, it'd be just as nice with some seared scallops or a little bit of roasted fish. Or if you're a vegetarian, you could do a little assortment of things. You know, have some of this sunchoke puree and some nice green beans, maybe a little lentil salad and a couple other dishes.
Find plenty of other recipes using root vegetables like sunchokes on our website. Also raw celery root salad and parsnip soup. You'll find plenty of recipes to inspire you at eartheats.org.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop. And Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction. Offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, Massage and Yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Sandor Katz, Cheryl Woodhouse-Keese, Gary Paul Napan, Chef Daniel Orr, and Mia Partlow. And thank you for listening. All the best until next time. I'm Annie Corrigan.